Accession number 20094, reel 17.
George Lester, reel 17.
The signal said, Morecambe Bay, proceed to the United Kingdom to Portsmouth as and when weather conditions permit you to do so. The last part of the signal, when weather conditions permit, was most significant because at that time, that part of the Atlantic was in the throes of a very, very heavy storm. And with the direction of the main direction of the wind blowing right into the small inlet, the bay, the harbour of Ireland and Bermuda, the difficulty of getting a ship out through the gap in the breakwater was quite hard. However, our captain was determined to get home. So we signalled up all lines and he rang down for half speed ahead, but connected a towing hawser line, a big grass line, about 4 inch diameter, to a bollard, and that ran over a wooden block. We cast off the last lines holding us to the shore and proceeded slow ahead inside the dockyard. We then made fast the towing hawser after we'd paid it out for about 40 or 50 yards, and he rang down for a few more revolutions. And this towing hawser was gradually getting thinner and thinner and thinner. Being a grass line, has a certain amount of elasticity. And at the same time, by helm orders, the ship was gradually veering towards the gap in the breakwater. And at a precise moment, he yelled out through the Armin broadcast, "Cut!" And the chief shipwright with a big axe chopped and we shot like a bow, like an arrow, because he had rung down some quite high revolutions for the ship anyway, and the froth from the screws, the wake from the screws was quite horrendous against the dockyard wall at the stern. But anyway, we got through. We were on our way home. That journey, the next few days, was the roughest sea I'd ever been in any ship. Even when we went to rescue the Canadian cruiser, it was worse than that. And again, of course, nobody was allowed on the upper deck. But I used to go up on the bridge. As I was the petty officer radio electrician, I was responsible for the radar and all the equipment. And in a cubbyhole to one side of the bridge, we had a remote plan position indicator for the 293 radar. This was the one that the navigator used to use. And I used to go up to have a check on that. The radar itself, in those weather conditions, was absolutely useless, because the surface range of the radar, with all that tremendous sea clutter and everything else, it was just impossible. If there'd been another ship, we wouldn't have seen it. The waves themselves, the swell, it was most disconcerting, as when standing on the bridge, to look up forward and see a mountain of water ahead of you, and look aft and see a mountain of water, and you were right down in the bottom, gradually riding up to it. The movement of the ship was quite erratic at times, because in those big long swells there were other waves of 25, 30, 40 feet, all going different ways. And it was on the second day, in the first dog watch, and after about 4:30 or 5 o'clock, we were hit on the port bow by one of the rogue waves. These are the waves which seem to go cross to the others, and as they meet, they form a pinnacle, and it's a big, heavy column of water. This hit us and virtually threw us over onto our starboard side. The inclinometer on the bridge, which went to, I think, 35 degrees, went over hard on the stops. I was sitting in the pedos mess, which was just underneath the bridge, on the starboard side. I finished up on the bulkhead, virtually almost standing on the bulkhead. All the equipment, mess table and everything else, that was all finished up there with me. But most significant, three banks of lockers on the inboard side of the mess, which were held by, retained against the bulkhead, retained by welded struts. The welding of these struts gave way, and these three lockers also finished up on the bulkhead, on the ship side bulkhead. So it was made worse actually by the lights going off the board at the same time. But the 24-volt emergency lighting system came on. It seemed to me like hours, in actual fact. It must have been about 10 to 15 seconds at the most. There was terrific vibration because the port screw was out of the water until they managed to cut the revs down on it. But gradually the ship staggered back up to a normal position, the lights came on again, and we started to sort the mess out. We managed to get the lockers back in position, bearing in mind that all the time the ship was being thrown around like a cork. And we managed to get the lockers back in position, and we had to lash them in position. And unfortunately, the POs who had their kit in those lockers couldn't use them because we had so much lashing on them, they couldn't get to the lockers. Eventually, as I say, the ship suffered some damage. We lost the motorboat, or it was smashed up in the davits. We lost our little, what we call skimmer, a little 14-foot motorboat that was smashed to matchwood where that went. Our dinghy, our sailing dinghy, which was stowed on a bracket between the depth charge racks, that disappeared. But the most significant one was the towing hawser, the one that used to carry the grass line. The towing hawser reel, which is held onto its base, welded base onto the deck, and held on by something like about a dozen 1.5-inch diameter bolts. That was just torn off the deck, and that disappeared overboard as well. All the guardrails were damaged, all bent and pushed all over the place. And we also ruptured a fuel tank, the torsional twist, and we started leaking a bit of oil, but lucky enough, the engine room branch managed to transfer a lot of that quickly before it got contaminated into other tanks. And so we playfully made our way back to the UK. Gradually the weather eased, much to our relief. In actual fact, going through the northern part of the Bay of Biscay, it was almost like the Serpentine in comparison to the what we had been through. And by the time we got to Spithead, it was really calm. We arrived at a time of each year at Spithead. We came in to Portsmouth Harbour at about 8:30 in the morning. 8:30 in the morning. And immediately went on the long side to South Railway Jetty. Some of the wives, luckily, were down there. These are the ones who live locally, Portsmouth or Southampton area. Unfortunately, Arlene couldn't get down with my two boys. Roger, who I'd never seen, he'd been born a few days after I left the United Kingdom. And he was now approaching 2 years old. Luckily, the navigating officer realised, he knew my family circumstances, that I hadn't seen my boy and everything else, and he immediately arranged for me to go on leave straight away for a few days until the official leave started, so I could come home and see my wife and newborn son, or my new son, I should say, not newborn. And so from Portsmouth Town Station, I got home. My little lad, the one I'd never seen, he'd never seen me either, obviously, and he took one look at me and hid behind his mum's skirt and looked shyly, peeped at me. I thought, well, don't be too overpowering as you're frightening him off for life. So I made of Keith, my eldest boy, who was then nearly six, in fact, he had coming up to six. He was all over me because I had corresponded with him. Every time I wrote a letter to Eileen, I said, I always wanted sketching. I sort of put a sketch in there on the back of a single pad for Keith, and he used to look forward to his letter. And I remember once when we did an emergency sailing once from Singapore. I just said mail closing in 30 minutes time, and I just dashed off a quick letter. I hadn't had time to do a sketch. And he got home, and the little lad was most put out because he didn't have his sketch, which he used to take and show the people at school. Anyway, when he saw that I was not the ogre that he thought I might be, he came round, and we got to know each other in those 2 days. Then I went back to Morecambe Bay. By this time, the leads were sorted out, and I came home then on 2 weeks' leave, 14 days' leave. when we got back and the other lead party got back, the ship then had to go into dry dock in Portsmouth, obviously because she had a leaking fuel tank that was leaking to the sea, so that had to be repaired, and also to other damage to this hull had to be checked and everything else. We went into the dry dock. I always hated going into dry dock on a ship. The simple reason is that as soon as you go into dry dock and the dock is emptied, or as soon as you go into the dock, obviously, in those days, you were not allowed to use the toilet facilities on board the ship. And usually the toilets were a little brick building, and the toilets and washrooms were a little brick building situated near to the dock. I say near, in Portsmouth, the one that we used had to serve three different docks, so it was a bit messy. Gradually, they moved the ship's company, the Morecambe Bay Ships Company, we moved off the ship and moved into the Royal Naval Barracks Portsmouth, which is now called HMS Nelson. It wasn't then, it was Victory 4. We moved as a ship's company into Royal Naval Barracks in Portsmouth. And we used to go daily to the ship to carry out our routines. As the Morecambe Bay was going to be, they came round and had a look at the messing situation, and they were going to do a lot of internal changes to the ship regarding messing and food and everything else. They decided that most of the ship's company would leave the Morecambe Bay. This happened around about the end of April, beginning of April 1955, and but certain senior rates were kept on. I was one. I think if I hadn't be coming up to completing my first 12 years service as a man service, I think I would have been drafted as well. But they knew that there was not much, they weren't going to get much mileage out of me now, as I was due to leave the Navy on the 31st of July. So I stayed with the ship. In fact, I think I was one of the last members on that ship. I used to go down the ship every day. I was not just idle, because I was given a task. Most of the equipment on a ship had what is known as an E-list, an equipment list. This is a list of spares which comes with every piece of equipment. Each piece of equipment has its associated E-list of spares. Now, in electronics, most of these E-lists had many, many common components. So I was given the task of working out from the records, from the log records, the defect logbook, and the E-list, a consolidated list to cover all equipment, which included the ASICs, the sonar, the armament broadcasts, the Metadyne amplifiers for the Bofors guns, to get a consolidated list for a Bay-class frigate on detached duty. Obviously, certain items I couldn't include. These would be like a replacement 234 50 cycles generator for the WT office, which we had to replace in Singapore, as you recall from earlier on. But I can part this list and this and submitted it, and in actual fact it was quite well received when I explained the logic behind it. And then I was sent for by my navigating officer. He was still, in fact, he'd been made commanding officer of the Morecambe Bay temporarily. Lieutenant Cassells, who later on became an admiral and was First Sea Lord at one time. And he, knowing that I was leaving the Navy, gave me a personal recommendation in an envelope with his wax seal on it, and said, "Don't use it until you have to." He said, "It'll have more impact that way." And I said, "Thank you, I thanked him very much." I wanted to have a look, but I thought, "No, I'll do as I'm told." And then I was drafted to Collingwood. In the Navy, I don't know if they do it now, but in those days you had what was known as EVT courses, educational and vocational training courses. And you could apply. These were normally carried out by civilian firms, and you could apply via your commanding officer, Collingwood, to go on a 4-week EVT course. I think the schools now call it work experience. I'm not quite certain, but anyway, it was that kind of procedure. So I applied. I'd been very, very taken up, as you can gather from previous comments, with the Decca 974 radar, the navigation radar. I thought that was a wonderful piece of kit. So I thought, I wouldn't mind getting to work with this kind of equipment. So I applied for an EVT course for the Decca radar. They came back and said I could have an EVT course, but it'd be with the Decca Radar Research Laboratories at Tolworth. But before giving the course, they would like to do an interview. So I went up there on the interview, and I didn't know whether to use this recommendation or not, but when they said that from the EVT course, if I was successful, or if they thought of that, they were well and truly consider giving me a position with them. So I furnished this recommendation, and Dr. Ap Simon, the who took the interview, and another chap, professor, who was a very, very senior engineer, they read this and they looked at me and said, "Have you seen this?" I said, "No." I said, "Would you like to read it?" I said, "Well, yes, I would." And when I read it, I think I blushed. But anyway, it was a very good recommendation. I still have it. It's one of my treasured souvenirs, that. Anyway, they brought out several things like components and all this, but the thing that amazed them more than anything else is when they produced certain components, I could give them the the RCB number. After giving them the Navy part number for them and things like that, they were quite taken aback. And I could tell them all about it. I did tell them that I had, during my instructional days at Collingwood, when I was instructing at during odd times, before going to Morecambe Bay, I used to lecture and teach juniors on components and what they were and how they were made and the capabilities and the disadvantages of certain types of components as used in certain circuits and what have you. They were quite impressed. And so I got the EVT course, and they put me with a group leader called Phil Knowles, who was then developing fixed coil displays. Not only fixed coil displays, but with interscans, so that you could put other scans on the display in the flyback period of the normal scan of the picture. This nowadays, this would be piece of cake, all been all digital and everything else, but in those days, bear in mind, it was still all electronic valve equipment. Transistors hadn't come into the country. In actual fact, the first transistors that got into Decca Radar research labs were smuggled in by the receiver engineer from America. I think this is the time that I was doing my EVT course in June 1955. And he made a little radio out of them and to demonstrate their capabilities. And other circuits, but he actually brought some back in his pocket from America. And when you consider what goes on now with the silicon chips and all the rest of it, it's absolutely amazing. But still, that's what you get when you have 45 years, because that's what it is since the first came into the country. But anyway, here we. I got on very well with this team, and also they were, I think I must have impressed them with my knowledge as well of electronics, practical, fault finding, and when I returned, or when I finished the EVT course, I was sent for. I said, well, we offer you a position as laboratory assistant in the Decca Radar Research Laboratories. And they quoted the salary that they were willing to pay me. It seemed all right to me, but bearing in mind that I had never had a civilian job in my life. I joined the Navy when I was 15. I was still at school on the traineeship at Exmouth. I joined the Navy. I still did school, but I'd never gone to, except for a Saturday morning job, I'd never gone and actually been employed by anybody other than the Royal Navy. So I think I was a bit naive. I think I could have negotiated a higher starting salary if I'd known about it. That's one thing that the Navy didn't tell you about. But be that as it may, I went back to Collingwood and